All right, it is 3 o'clock. Welcome everybody to practical uses and optimizations of new T-SQL features in SQL Server 2012. I hope you had a good start into TechEd this morning with the opening sessions that we had, and I'm glad so many people actually came here and looking into this. My name is Jan Engelsberg. I'm a program manager in SQL Server. And I'm working in the team that owns the T-SQL language. Hence, I'm here to present these new features. We're going to look at, first of all, key generation. What are scenarios that already exist there? And what did we introduce in 2012 to do further support there? Second thing is we're going to look at exception and messages. We added a new capability there that can become handy and is easier to use. We'll be looking at calculations and aggregations, and then we'll close it as with some common tasks, kind of like everyday work that everybody has to do that can probably be more easier. All right, key generation. When I talk about key generation right now, I'm always be talking about generating global IDs. By global IDs, I mean IDs that are not only generated for one table, but that are potentially meant to be used over multiple tables. And if you want to generate IDs over multiple tables, this kind of like the scenarios. The first use case would be, imagine you have a customer table where you store your customers in, you have an employee table where you store all your employee contact data, and then you want to generate an address book. Just generate a view over it. And for this view, you want to have unique IDs. This would be an example where you have two tables and want to have unique IDs across those two tables. The other scenario that we are going to looking at is if you look at distributed systems or client-side processing of things. For example, if you want to prepare files for a batch import, you would potentially want to generate these IDs on the client side, use them there, generate your batch import files, and then hand it over to the database. So far, before SQL Server 2012, what we had was the support for GUIDs. You could essentially manage this with creating your own tables with IDs in it. And what we added in SQL Server 2012 is the capability for sequences. We've presented sequences before, so we're just going to do a quick recap about what sequences are. It's a new object within the database, and it's meant to eventually replace the identity column. As it is a new object in the database, it separates the ID generation from the tables and columns where it was before. We have an ANSI SQL standard compliant implementation for this, and then on the right-hand side of the slide, you can see roughly a quick recap on the syntax. So you can create a sequence, you can define a type, any integer type, starting from tinyint. You can set a start value, you can set an increment, min value, max value. You can say, should it cycle or not? So if you go over the range on the one hand side, depending on in which direction you go, should we cycle back to the other side of the range and start again from there? And you can set a cache value for the sequence. To get a number, a sequence number, you call the next value for function, specify the sequence. Second option to get numbers is to call a stored procedure sp sequence get range that essentially lets you reserve a range of values that you're then going to use. With that said, let's look at the first demo. If you look at this, so right now I'm going to show you the first use case that we had, essentially the two tables, employees and customers, using unique identifiers. We have the unique identifier as a primary key, and as a default, we call the new ID value function to get the GUID out of the system. And the same for the customer table, and then we also reference the employee table, kind of like primary contact, as the column is called. So let me just generate this, complete it successfully, which is very good. So this is no big magic here. So now if you want to insert some values into these tables and you want to use the same ID for the reference there. What you can do is you can declare a variable as a unique identifier, get the GUID in there, and then just insert multiple sets of data using this variable that you declared in multiple places. So if I do this, you can see roles affected. I can do this multiple times. Everything is working fine. We can have a quick look at the. Oh, very good. Okay, I'm not getting it. So trust me, the data is there. All right, here we go. It's very good. I've planned to do lots of typing today, and it's good that it already doesn't work in the first, in the ones that I had prepared. Okay, so now we can do is just add a whole bunch of data in there. I just get some names from the all objects table here, generate GUIDs. We're putting like roughly 2,000 columns in there. All very good. Now let's create the view over this data. So just do a union over the two tables. Again, nothing really fancy. Let's create this view. Very good. And then can display this data over here. And I hope it's big enough. I can also zoom in there. So you see here are the GUIDs. It is ordered by ID. What you can see, there are actually no phone numbers showing up at the top, which is at least to some degree surprising because I actually added them first. You would have expected that these IDs are on the top here, which they are not. Can try to be lucky and find them. Well, here you saw a different type, the employee type. So this shows up somewhere in the middle, and the other, the customers, are the phone numbers that I entered before are there as well. So this is all, should be nothing new. This is how it was done before. Now let's have a look how this would look like if you use sequences. So let me just copy this, and then I'll use this as the base for the further examples we got up here. So the first thing, if you want to use a sequence, is obviously we need to create the sequence. Calling it demo contacts sequence. I want it as integer, and I want it to start with 1. Should hopefully work. Very good. So now we have created the sequence. I can say next value 4, demo contacts sequence. Obviously, I need to select that. And I get the sequence value as expected. So now, what do I need to do to rewrite this example? First of all, I need to change types. I specified the sequence should be an int. So now I'm putting the int in. And as I'm a little lazy and typing is difficult on stage, I do a copy and paste here. Just from this sequence to get the next in value. So whenever we actually insert something in this table, just by default, we'll get a sequence value. And I obviously also need to rename this, call it sequence. Same for the customers table, just call it sequence, change this to int, paste the sequence in here. And then also what we need to do is to change the reference here, use the correct values, and if I typed it all correctly, it should hopefully do this. All right. So that worked. So right now, I just changed the base tables to use the sequences. Same for inserting data. Again, just I changed the type of the variable, tell it to use the sequence, the next value for function to generate the values. Need to rename them here and here. And here, and then it should hopefully work. All right, so I can easily insert data here. So you can see there's no big change, essentially, when you used GUIDs before. It's pretty easy to switch to sequences for these kind of scenarios. Well, that we don't necessarily need to do right now. And then again, what I'm going to do again is insert a whole bunch of data here, and then we need to call the next value function here as well. All right, that worked as well. And now let's also create the view for the sequences that we have here. Sequence. All right, that worked as well. And now we do the same select here. And again, you get the full result set. What you can see here is that actually the data that I inserted first is on top of this view, which is due to the ordering and the fact that the sequence generates the values in actually a sequential order, which is not guaranteed for the GUIDs if you do not use the proper function. All right, so with this, let's switch to, so this covers the first scenario. I'm not going to demonstrate how the table works when you have your own table that generates IDs. I'll have this in a second example, but I'm not going to use it here. It's essentially the same thing that you would just do a select from this table, an update from this table and get the value back. Let's look at the second thing. Let's do some performance first here. So I have a function right here that executes the same statement that takes the roughly 2,000 objects that I have in the database and pastes this into the two tables. I'm going to iterate this 100 times, so I'm actually doing a bigger amount of data that I'm going to insert there. Shoot this statement against my SQL server, and then I'm just going to output the time that it takes. And here you can see the two statements. So it's exactly the same that you just saw, right? It's insert into customer GUIDs and insert into customer sequence. And I'm going to execute this. This will take a few seconds. So it's roughly about yeah. Probably again a typing. Let me just. Yeah. It's very good. All right, now it should hopefully work with the spell error in there. Actually, later in the slide deck, we'll show you another spell error that we officially released, so it's not too embarrassing for me to do it now. All right, you can see the sequence now is actually slower, right, which is not very good. Luckily, we can do some tweaking here. What we can do is we can specify a different cache size for the sequence. So we can just say alta this sequence that I spelled wrong. Alta sequence. Here we go. And then say cache, let's say 200,000. Execute this. Now, if we execute this demo here again, you'll see that this will actually increase the performance of the sequences. Hopefully, by quite a bit. We'll see. So now the GUIDs are even slower than before. And now you can see that the sequences are actually way faster. The difference is the default cache size is currently set to 50. And what we need to do is we need to actually persist this data whenever we exceed the cache, which is why the performance goes down a little bit. Another thing that you can do, and there are blog posts out there, if you want to insert IDs into an index, you can actually, every second one, you can flip the bits. And as I said, there's a blog post that actually explains that. this flipping the bit essentially has as a result that you negate the value that you get. So you always generate a value at the positive and a negative value. This is a better performance when you insert stuff into indexes because we need to do less paging. We have to have less, when you move around the index. So this reduces it, and you essentially insert at both sides of the index, which is an additional performance gain. And as I said, there are blog posts out there that actually explain that. Let's do a last example on this one. And here I'm actually going to create a table that generates the values. Let's go over this one. So I generate a second sequence, and I'm generating a table that contains the IDs. Okay. All right, here we go. And what we're going to do right now is we have a XML file that contains order data. And it has essentially three orders and a couple of items for each order. What I'm going to do right now in a client-side application is I'm going to grab a value for an ID and create two files from which we're going to bulk. Oh, I'm not actually going to do the bulk insert operation, but I prepare two files that we then can use for a bulk insert operation. And I'm going to put in these files, I'm going to put the reference ID for the items to the orders. So if we look at this right here, we load this XML file, we create two text files that we're going to write into, we're going to iterate over the XML elements, and then write the lines into the two files. And we're going to use three different methods, and we have this function called generate ID that we, or GUID ID, ID GUID in this case, that we hand in. You can see it's actually one liner to retrieve a new GUID. If you want to do the same thing for sequences, now you can use the sp-get-range stop procedure and reserve a range of values. It is a little more tricky to actually do this on the client side because you need to maintain the state. The only thing that you get from the sequence is the value, the last value that you can use in this range. So you have to locally maintain the state, and whenever you reach the maximum value, you actually need to grab the sequence values again. So you can see, I'm not going into great detail here, but as you can see, the code is exceptionally longer than the one compared to the GUID call. And then you can see I call the function and store the data, give it a range size. I'm going to fetch 10 values for the sequence here. And then we have the same thing if you have a table that generates the IDs for you. It's the same thing. You need to store the information locally and maintain the state here. And the code looks roughly the same, as a few lines shorter, though. And here you can see you just do an update and update the value and then just get the last value that you have there. If you run this, these functions up here. If we just run this one. So the first one used the tables, and if we look into the output files, you can see it's 1, 2, 3 for the items, and then for the corresponding orders, we have the same IDs in here, and they are referenced. If you insert this in a bulk insert, you do not have to care about the reference keys because you already have them in there. Second one, if you do the same thing for the GUIDs. Yes, please. You will see now you have the GUIDs in these files. Also, not spectacular. It's less readable. Hope everybody can see this. So here the first digits up until the names are the GUIDs that we generated. And the last one, not very different from the first one. If you now use the sequences, we'll get the IDs that we generated again as 1, 2, 3, and so forth in both. And then, as I said, these files are now completely prepared. You can just hand them over and bulk insert them into the database. And the key here is that the IDs, you have these IDs pre-generated, and you don't have to do it there again. All right. For this demo, let's switch back. So what are the pros and cons of these different concepts? As you saw, there's like different things are probably better used for different situations. So GUIDs are globally unique, and this is guaranteed, right? Whereas if you use other concepts, they're more locally, a sequence is local to the database. So this is definitely an advantage of the GUIDs. You can make them sequential, but this has a few caveats. One thing is, if you, for example, if you fail over to a different machine, you get a different range of GUIDs, right? And this range might actually be before the range that you previously used. So they are sequential, but only to some extent. And as you could see in the example before, if you're not actually called a getNextSequentialID GUID function, this is not going to work. A security advantage for those, they cannot be guessed, right? Because they're generated based on the local machine environment. Some cons for GUIDs is they're very large. They need 60 bytes of storage. Not all systems actually support them. And it can cause fragmentation within indexes because they are, if you not generate them sequentially, you insert different parts of the tree that we use for the index, which causes the fragmentation. And then, as I said, the con is even if you try to make them sequential, you're not guaranteed to actually get them in a proper order. Pros for the table, you can use any data type, essentially anything that you can use in the table itself, you can obviously use. You can guarantee continuous range of values, and you can, as I demonstrated, you can also do this range thing that we did, which you cannot do for GUIDs. And it is serialized across transactions by nature because you actually do operations in the database. This is also a con, actually, because you need to be careful. This can be a performance hit. If lots of stuff is accessing this table, you can get into performance issues. And this is obviously not natively an RDBMS support, except for the fact that you use a table, and you would potentially need more code. Sequences, pros, so we support all integer types, up from tiny int up to decimal 38,0. It's easier to sort them. You have all the benefits of integer values that you get or that you can order and sort. It supports range reservation, as I showed before, using the store procedure, and you have this caching knob that lets you tune the performance a bit depending on what your needs are. We cannot guarantee a continuous range of values. That essentially means if your machine does a dirty shutdown, for example, you lose the values that are in the cache and that are not used because we do not persist this data. So if you have a cache of 200,000 values, you use the first one, and then your machine crashes, you essentially lose 200,000 minus one values in the sequence. We guarantee, though, that you will never get a duplicated value. So it's just the range that you have left over gets a little smaller. We did a calculation. If you use integer type and you generate roughly 10 IDs per second, I think you can use it for 12 years if you use the whole range. So it's not a huge deal if you lose the values, but that's something to keep in mind. So if you have to have a continuous range, that's probably not the solution, or you need to turn the cache down to one value, which means we actually persist everything, whereas then you get a bad performance. Yeah, any questions on this one so far? Yeah. So the question is, the caching knob is only for connections? No, so the caching knob applies on the server. So it's essentially you set this knob for the sequence itself, and it just essentially defines on when do we persist the data to remember where you were in the sequence. And this is just, so it's an in-memory operation, and it's just a lot faster if you use the cache rather than actually having a write and read operation every single time you access the transaction. But this has nothing to do with client versus, so it's a property on the sequence. Another question? It's the same thing. So the sequence, the cache of the sequence gets initiated when you call the function the first time. So if we persist the data, this gets replicated to the secondaries, and if you then go to the secondary, we would then start up at the new highest end. So we also guarantee that there are no duplicates there. Okay. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So it's not. Yeah. It's not a table. Yeah. Correct. No. Correct. Okay. So I thought there were like a few more. I just took a look at the watch. Let's take that to the end, if you're okay with that. Honestly, I actually do not know. But I believe no, but let me, if you could step at the end, I'll look this up. Yeah. All right, so next topic is exceptions and messages. So what we're looking here is how do you like send updates and messages to your application. Second thing would be logging events just on the fly when you go along. And the third thing is obviously actually the error handling, raise exceptions and handle them. Up until today, you had raise raw, and this is the spelling error that we shipped, right? Raise raw, it's not raise error. We have XP log event. You can have a logging table that you create on your own, or what we introduced right now in SQL Server 2012 is the new throw keyword. Just a few reminders for throw. So it looks similar to raise raw. You can specify a number, a message, and a state. The error number has to be greater than 50,000. Because the other range is reserved. It always aborts the batch. We have set exec, except for if you have sec exec abort on, which then obviously the transaction is terminated. It does not automatically use the sysstop messages. We spelled it correctly, hopefully. And you have the capability of rethrowing exceptions. And I'm going to show you that in a second. Okay. Looking at this. So if you look at this, this is how raising errors used to be, or still actually able to do so. So if I execute this one, you can see, oh, my fault. Sorry. Thank you. So then again, so raise raw as we have it right now. So if you specify a severity level under 10, we'll just essentially print this. And nothing much is happening. So this is, in the end, just the message that you sent. If we turn the severity level a little higher, you now have an exception that is being raised. Then again, we do not batch abort here, right? And I think with the 17, also the behavior changes a little. We print it in a different way, right? We do the print first and then raise the error. Not exactly sure why this is happening. But you can see there are multiple different behaviors depending on the severity levels that you set. So now it gets even more interesting. If you create a procedure that just raises an error and prints it, and let's do the second one already as well, it also does the same thing, just with a different severity level. So the first one did it with severity level 11, and this one does it with a severity level 10. If you now execute the first stop procedure, you can see the exact same behavior that you had before when I just executed it in the batch. If I execute the second one, again, it's the same behavior as we saw before. Now comes the tricky part. If you put this in a try-catch block, what happens now is that we do a batch abort. So now the behavior of the severity level 11 changes, and we do not print out the message that we had before. Whereas for the other severity level, what happened? Oh, okay. So for the severity level 10, we do not do that. So there's like a switch in behaviors, and that can be at times tricky. For example, if you look at this, This is like a common way of writing a stop procedure. You start a transaction, and at some point there's an error. You erase this error, and then do a rollback for the transaction, and then just return out of the stop procedure. If you would execute a stop procedure like that, it would behave totally fine. It would roll back the transaction and then return. If you put this in a try-catch block, we would not roll back the transaction anymore because we actually abort there. So there are a few tricks to using RAISE-ROR. And just as a quick summary, so severity levels 0 to 10, we actually print. 11 to 19, we have errors. Everything over 20 would cut the connection. And you can specify with lock that just does a writing into the lock file. And you can say with no wait, if you just want to hand over a message to the application, we then just send this message directly without waiting for a buffer to actually get filled up so that we can send it in a batch. Another thing with the exception handling as it was before, so if you try to do something that causes multiple exceptions, which I'm going to do right now, so I don't have an X drive, so this operation will fail, you will only get one error there. So now, what did we do about it? So first of all, we introduced this new throw, and as I showed before, you can give it a number, a message, and a state, and we will always abort the batch, so there's never anything happening beyond that. And so here you would get the expected behavior in this one, if I just throw the error. Now if I do the same backup example, what you can see, and oh yeah, so need to mention this. So you can see I specified throw in the catch block as well. This is the rethrow capability. So we take all the errors that popped up and actually throw them to the next level. So if I execute this one right now, so first of all, the result is from the select error message. So you see this, these mechanisms work the same as they did before. And here you can see that this, due to this rethrow that I did, you get actually both error messages that happened, which is the first one is it cannot open the backup device because the hard drive simply doesn't exist. And then the backup is terminated. All right, so much for the exceptions demo. Also looking at pros and cons here, so I didn't show the lock event and the logging tables. These are fairly common things, I guess, and it's just logging. Pros of the RAISE-ROR is it's extremely flexible, as you saw before, and it's well known because it's a mechanism that we had for quite a while in the product already. The cons here, due to the multiple behaviors, it can actually be tricky, and I showed you some of them. And if you're not very careful in how you write your code, you might run into these situations, and it can get difficult to catch those. Throw is way easier to use. It has similar behavior to other programming languages, so this is not a really new concept that we introduced here. And you have these rethrow capabilities that I just showed, where you can take the error messages that you have and throw them all. And then, obviously, in this case, it's less flexible than RAISE-ROR, so you cannot send messages with throw, because this is really meant for exception handling. Lock event, just logging into the logging without sending actually messages to the client, which you could do with RAISE-ROR. This is not available in Azure due to the nature of the service, whereas throw we actually introduced. The logging table is obviously, from the messages that you can store, is the most flexible one because you just define whatever you actually need, and then you can put it in there. You need to be careful when you do this in transactions. So if you roll back a transaction, you might roll back your lock events, right? So these are like things where you can run into trouble when you use these. Okay, any questions on throw? All right, very good. Then let's look at the next big one, calculations and aggregations. As you probably saw on the last TechEd already, we introduced window functions, and this is what this section will be mostly about. The use cases would be what happens if you want to include aggregations into details. So if you want to show a list of entries from a table and show aggregations within this list. This is something that we haven't had integrated support for this one so far. Second thing is, if you want to reference other roles than the one you're currently in, we didn't have support for this one so far. So options that you had was imperative programming patterns. It's essentially using cursors and approaching things as you would have done it in other programming languages. You can write correlated subqueries, or now you can use window functions. Then just a quick recap on what window functions are. So imagine you have this table and it contains transactions, or it's, you're a bank and you have a table of transactions, right? And it's a very good bank because there's only money going in, never going out. So if you want to now do a calculation like what is the transaction cost if every transaction is $1.50 in this example, well, it's trivial because you can just take the amount and add this $1.50 and give it as an additional output. So this would be a calculation within a row. This is easy to do. But what if you want to do calculate the current bank balance for every transaction that is coming in? Or what if you want to do the current account balance for after every transaction? Or number of days since the last transaction happened? Or the amount of the previous transaction? So these kind of operations get more tricky when you want to calculate this. So window functions, how does that actually work? So let's take as an example, we want to calculate the average amount of the last three transactions. Right? The window functions now give you the capability of defining a window over which you want this aggregate, the average, to happen. So you can define a partition, you can define an ordering, and you can define a frame over this data. So in this case, we have a partition, which is only one partition because we want to do it over all transactions. Then you have a frame that now will roll over this data while we actually do the calculations of the average. So for the first row, it's trivial, right? The average of 120 is 120. For the second run, it's 500 plus 120 divided by 2. And so far, the frame is just getting bigger and bigger, and we're taking more rows into consideration. So now that we said we only want to do a three transaction average, now we would move this frame over the data that you have to further calculate the three-day average of the transactions until we actually reach the end of this data set. So if you look at this picture, this is roughly the concept of how a window and a window over data works. The second animation that I have here is if you want to now, let's calculate the balance for the different accounts. For this one, you would have two partitions because in here, you can see it's partitioned by the account ID. You have two different accounts in here. The data is ordered by the transaction date. And then again, now, if we look at the frame that goes over the data, it would just sum up. And here you can see we would just extend for each row, we would just take into consideration what have been the rows before and just calculate the balance over those. Once you actually get at the end of the first partition, we would switch to the second partition and the frame would start from there again. All right, so these are the functions that we currently have, whereas in green, these are the new functions that we added. So aggregations like average, count, min, max, and so forth, they were already there. And they are all now supported with this window concept over the data. We do not support user-defined CLR functions with this windowing concept yet. We had a few analytical functions that were also very powerful that have been introduced before that to some degree supported the windowing, which was row number, entire rank, and dense rank. And we added the cumulative distance and the percent rank to the list of analytical functions. Then we have distribution functions, which is their percentile, continuous version, and a discrete version. And I'll show you what the difference is there. And then we added functions that actually let you point to different rows in the set of data that you currently have. All right, let's look at an example here as well. So let me first create this transaction table. It's the same as you just saw. and then also insert the same data that we have, plus actually a third account. All right, so now we have 18 rows in that table. And the first thing I want to do is look at the iterative approach, or the imperative programming approach, essentially using a cursor solution. So if you have a cursor, you first of all need to have some sort of temporary table where you put your data in, and then what you need here for the calculation, it's somewhat following the picture that you saw before, right? You run over the data, store the amount, and then you grab the next row, add the amount, and put this data into the temporary table. So right here, we just get the cursor onto the transaction table, and then here, we iterate over the data, and the running total is just the amount plus the running total that we had before, and then this value would just get added into the temporary table, and then we fetch the next cursor until we do not have any cursors left. We have to close all this stuff, and then at the end, for the output, what I do is I take the transaction table and just join it to this temporary table. So I didn't fetch all the data out of the table and put it in a temp table, but just join it at the end. So if you look at this, this will hopefully create roughly the same result that we saw on the slides. Here you can see is the balance is calculated for each transaction for all 18 rows. All right. So now the second approach would be the correlated subquery. This is way more the set-based thinking than the imperative programming thinking. And this is the query here already. So what we do is we select over that table, and then to calculate the sum, we actually do an additional select over the table, calculate the sum of the amount from this transaction table, and then, let me get this out first for a second, all right? And then we just look at all the transactions that were before the transaction that we're currently looking at in the other table. So this is essentially, if you think about this animation that I had, is again just taking all the rows before, doing the sum over it, and then just output this as a balance. Let me also take this out for a second. All right. So now if I execute this, you see here again, it calculates the balance, and it is the same as with a cursor solution before for all the rows. So now, let's do it with a window function. Just copy this, put it in here. Just modify it to use a window function, so I still want the amount. I need to change this here. And now I just eliminate the subquery that we had before and say over order by trun date. I think I had to call it T1, right? And then I say rows between unbounded preceding and current row. So this, what I just did, is specifying the window. So I gave it an ordering, and I gave it this frame definition. So I want to, for every row, I want to look at all the rows that were before within the current partition, and I want to do it up until the current row. So this is this frame definition. I didn't specify a partition here right now because I want to look at all the data, so there's no need to really do partitioning. So if I execute this right now, okay, again, a spelling error, very good. Here we go. Oh, yeah. All right. He's never live type in demos. It worked out all very well in the training. Okay, here we go. So now it calculated the values properly. See, no surprise, it's the same result. So now you might ask, well, why all this, right? It almost looks the same as the correlated subquery. What is the difference between the two? So if we look at the plan, that are getting the plants that are getting generated for those two queries. You can see that for the first one, which is the correlated subquery, we actually need to look at the data multiple times, whereas for the window function, we only need to look at the data once and can do all the calculations with this one index scan that we had over the data. And this is the main difference. So the correlated subquery, it has a quadratic complexity. So if you do this for huge amounts of data, the calculations will take extremely long, up to a point where you can actually never finish these calculations. Itzig Ben-Gan showed this last year at TechEd also, and he did a calculation, and I think with 1 million rows, you can already not finish this calculation in time. I think that was the calculation. So this is the main difference between those two approaches, right? Even though the correlated subquery is the set-based thinking that you should have when you use SQL, it is from a performance perspective, you run into problems because you can just never finish. Okay, so what you can do to further boost the performance here, we had a sorting in there based on the date. So I just created an index on this one. And let me also turn on the statistics to show performance differences again. So now if I execute this again and we look at the plants again, so now you can see that the plants got slightly better due to the fact that we do not have to sort the data anymore. And now you can also see in terms of cost for this batch that the window function approach is way better, right? So you can see here it's only 26% of the whole batch cost is for the window function approach, whereas 74% of the cost for the correlated subquery, which is simply due to the fact that we need to do more data reads. So if you look right here, you can see the scan count for the correlated subquery is 19, and we had way more logical reads, whereas the scan count for the window function approach is 1, right? It's only one scan over the data. And this is the performance optimization that we did there and that you get from using window functions. All right. Okay, so turn the statistics off again. Let's look at another example. So this would be a way to calculate this three transaction average in a world without, well, it's not exactly without window functions because I use row number here that also uses the window function support that we had up until 2012. So what I do here is I go over the data and generate a row number for each row in this data so that I'll be able in a second run over the data with a correlated subquery to choose the three rows with the same ordering that were there in the order before. And this choosing the three rows is essentially what happens here, and then I want to do this up onto the current row. So I essentially define the frame within the where clause of the correlated subquery. If I execute this, you will see it's hopefully the same values again as in the presentation. The same thing you can write again with a window function. Let's put it in here, and it's demo transactions. And here again, we just eliminate the correlated subquery and use the window function term. Again, saying over, and then order by tran date, rows between three preceding and current row. And if everybody paid attention, this actually has to be two because the current row is part of it, so we're only looking two back. So if I execute this, hopefully I didn't make any spelling errors, we get the same results as before. And again, you do the performance, you just by using the window function, you get the performance boost out of this. So now, As I said, you can do partitioning here, and I haven't showed that before, so let's do it here. You can say partition by account ID, and then just order by this account ID. So what it will do now is it will actually go and only do this calculation within this partition that we had, and it will stop at the end of the first partition, which you can see here. When it switches from account ID 1 to 2, you can see the calculation of the average resets, and it goes back to 500 in this example, and then the frame starts there again and goes over the data. If you wanted to do this in the example up here, you could do a partition by account ID up here, which is where we now would just generate the row numbers over for each account, essentially. And then in the where clause here, you would have to say where account ID, that was not good. Here we are. Where account ID equals T account ID, and do this. And now it also produces this result again, where it then starts doing the calculation again over the next account. Here again, you get the bad performance due to the fact that we cannot optimize this, or we do not recognize that we can optimize it, whereas with the window functions, we actually do. All right, so then again, you might still like, okay, performance, but then again, why is it so much simpler, right? So you can just easily, for the window functions one, you can just easily also do additional calculations here, and let's just use the same frame. S, let's call it 3 tron balance. So what I did right now is I just added a second calculation to this one, right? And you saw it was literally like a copy and paste and changing the function name here. And now what we do is we calculate this value in there as well. You can see if you do a correlated subquery approach, you would have to like modify multiple where clauses. The filters get more difficult. You need to make sure that you do it everywhere. Plus, you would get way more iterations over the data. Whereas you can see here, again, we only look once at the data because the window that we use is essentially the same. And the frame is also the same. So we recognize this. We know we do not resort it. I hope, well, it did sort, actually. So take that back. That's one of the drawbacks we might. If you have multiple window functions in the same query, we might not recognize a better way of not sorting it if you have it in a different order. But then again, here, it's only looking at the data once, right? And this is the big advantage that you get out of it. All right, then looking at the referencing a previous row. It looks slightly similar to the one that you saw before. We again generate the row numbers over the base table of the transactions that you see here. And then we do a select and we give out the transaction date. Then I, in the second row over here, I print out the last transaction date that happened before, which is essentially just taking a correlated subquery, look at the row that was in the ordering before when I generated the row numbers for the tables. And then I do a date diff and use the subquery again. And you can see it's like here I'm already using the subquery twice. So it's not very well. And here, that's the output of the query. If I run it and it calculated, there's like between most of the transactions, there's only one day in between. Some of them have five. And you can see nicely that I did copy and paste to generate the data, right? Because there's a pattern in there. So, come on. Same thing now with the window function, and this is one of the new functions that we actually added. Is we take out the correlated subqueries and say Trundate 1 over, order by Trundate is the last transaction. No, it's T, okay. To change the name as well. And the same thing I just put in here for the calculation. Again, just referencing the row before from demo transactions. Should hopefully work. See, here you get the same output. And then again, we can actually optimize this by just knowing that you just want to reference this row. And then here again, if you look at the plan, it is again only one lookup of the data. And we know what to reference. And if you want to look at something else, let's say we just want to look at three transactions back, something like that, it's easy, super easy to just recalculate this, right? And then here again, you can actually see a pattern by that. Also, this also supports partitioning. So if you would want to look at within the accounts, like what are my customers from a bank perspective, partition by account ID. Put this in here, and then let's also order by account ID. If you put it in here, you can easily rewrite this to just looking at the accounts, and then you can see people actually have similar usage patterns, right? They always do something once a week. Maybe it's paycheck coming in. All right, then the last one that I want to show here, and I'm promising no typing. This is the percentile continuous and the percentile discrete that I mentioned before. So with these ones, you can essentially calculate a median. And I'm going to do a partition over the account, so I want to find out what is the median for each account. If I execute this, now you see you get the whole list of data. And in the last column, you see the differences between the continuous and the discrete calculation that we did. It is for the continuous calculation, we actually take the values and calculate the exact median value or the 50th percentile value, whereas for the discrete approach, we look into what is the data in the database and output this data. So for the discrete one, you actually get a value that is in the table, whereas for the continuous one, you might or will likely get a value that is not in the database because we calculated it. And so you see these work are slightly different. They use this within group, within the SQL standard, these two functions are also there as pure aggregates without using the window definition. We currently do not support this. So we only support this with the over clause, which defines the window. So if you want to, if you just want to output the data per account, which is probably the more likely what you would want to do here, you have to rewrite and use a distinct, and then we just collapse the data by hand, essentially, by using the distinct one with just losing the details. All right, and last one, also referencing within the rows is for first value and last value. What we do right here is just print out the first value for an account that got entered and the last value. As you can see, this is also working out very well. The first value was 120 for the first account, and the last value that was entered is 175. So you have a bunch of tools now where you can reference other columns within a partition or within a set of data where you before had to manually do this and write queries manually and essentially with a bad performance, or you use programming patterns that were not, not say that we're not meant for SQL, but that are not actually in the set-based thinking. Okay, so let's switch back. few of the advantages, disadvantages. So the imperative approach was commonly known, right? Most of the modern, there are a bunch of programming languages out there that are very widely used that use this approach. So you might be more familiar with actually using this one, right? It's kind of like as you already think about the calculation, right? The cons of this one is, as I said, it's not set-based, right? We can not optimize this except for the individual queries that you use within this approach. And as you could see in the example, there are actually a whole bunch of lines of code that you have there, and it is tricky to maintain this, and there's a higher risk of actually making errors in there. The correlated subquery, you follow the set-based thinking, right? That's, I would argue, the right approach to take. But it just has this problem of the bad performance, its quadratic complexity, and it can get non-trivial to write. As I said, if you want to do multiple calculations for the same output, you have to make sure that all the filters are always correct. If you want to change the partitioning, stuff like that, so it gets difficult to write these queries. The window functions, it has an improved performance simply due to the fact that we now recognize what you want to do and what the approach is, and then we can optimize this when we create the plan and we do the calculations. It is easier to write, as I hopefully showed. I made less mistakes than in the other examples. And again, it is following the paradigm of using sets. A few drawbacks. We are not always actually generating the optimal solution. So what we saw with the sorting that happened, that should not have happened. These things, sometimes you need to have an eye on this one and have to make sure that you do not get into these traps where we actually do operations that are not necessarily needed. This can sometimes be avoided by just moving around the aggregates in a different order. And then actually not all queries can easily be rewritten using those window functions. Any questions on this one at the moment? Yes? So the question is, why do we not always generate the right plan? So if you look at the different frame definitions, we cannot always figure out which is the right order to process these just to do minimal amount of sorting, for example. So sometimes we look at the frame and for some reason think, oh yeah, that's the easiest frame to calculate first, but therefore we have to sort the data, even though it comes sorted in a different way out of an index that you could use for another frame that we process later. So these are the scenarios that I'm talking about. So just depending on the frame definition, we might not pick the best order to calculate this. Yeah, it will. Yeah, we will take all this into consideration. It's just like sometimes we just make a bad choice of picking the wrong calculation first, which adds more calculation or no, sorting and stuff to it. Yeah. Right? Pardon? No. All right, then let's go on to the last topic, common tasks. Just a few things that probably a bunch of us have to do every day is like transform data to and from strings. It's construction of date instances from just a bunch of input data, handle conversions, and paging. So far, essentially what you could do is write all this yourself, right? Write stored procedures that do these things for you, do transformations, handle conversion errors, do paging, stuff like that. What we did is we added a bunch of scalar functions, and what I show as well, which is not on the slide, is we added support for paging, and we added a support in a slightly different context, but it can be handy to use. We added support for enforcing contracts on result sets for dynamic SQL. So the scalar functions that we added, we have triconvert and tricast, which is essentially a conversion into a different data type. The key here is that we will not throw an error if this conversion doesn't work. So instead, we will return null, which if you want to just process a huge data set, right, and like at some point there's an object that you cannot parse or cast or convert, we would just abort this operation. You have no idea where in the data it happened, right? Now we actually return null. You can then on identify where this happened, or you can even do a try or like a dry run of the data to just find out where are the values that are not be able to parse, to cast or convert, by just applying a filter and say where this output is null. Second thing is we added a bunch of conversion functions for strings, which is the format, parse, and try parse. Try parse follows the same logic of we are not actually failing you, and the format, I'll show this in the demo. Parsing, for example, dates into a string. Other functions that we added is IF, just a slightly different way of doing Boolean expressions, and if you're familiar with Excel and stuff like that, it looks the same. We added choose, which is like an index that you can pick from the values. So, and I'll show this in an example as well, is if you, for example, you get an integer and want to figure out which day of the week it is, right? You can just define the weeks, the days of the week, as the options that you have, and then just give the int that you get as the index, and then we just get the right one out. And then the last one is the concat, which allows you to concat strings, and we added a bunch of functionality here that comes handy. For example, we handle nulls for you, and you can parse, you can hand in any data type, and we will actually parse this into a string. And I'll show this as well. Bunch of the operations that we added to generate dates and date types, go through the list, pick whichever you need. The more complex the input, the longer the name. Essentially, one that could come in is actually end of month, that you just give it a date and we give you the last day of this month. Then offset fetch, just support for paging. This is also in the standard. You have an order and then you can just specify an offset, which just lets you skip a few rows and then you can say fetch next, and then I don't know, amount of rows that you want to have on this paging result. And the last one, the enforce contract for result sets. So this one looks pretty complicated. Essentially what it is you can, when you execute dynamic SQL or even a stored procedure, you can tell it what you expect the result set to look like, right? And if the result set is not what you specified or what you think it should be, we will throw an exception. And I just added this, so this is documented books online as well. We'll have a look at this one in the demo right now as well. Just do this. Switch over here. All right. So paging, as probably all of it did it before, can use the same approach with the row number, and then you just apply a filter over the row ID or row number that you generated, and thus get the parts of the result set that you actually want. So right now I specified an offset of 10, and then I fetch 15 rows, and I'm using the adventure works here. Oh yeah, okay, I obviously need to include those. All right, go back, here we go. Unfortunately, the data, as I saw earlier, is not very good as an example data because it's just an order date and an ID and the comments are null. Sorry for that, but so I think you get the idea. How it works with the offset and fetch is you just specify this after the order by, and you have to have the order by. You just say offset, and then here I hand in the parameters as well if you want to do it dynamically. You can also just specify, for example, skip 10 here and then skip 15 here. It's the same as just using the input parameters, right? And you would get the same data, which, again, is now difficult to compare, actually. But it's the same thing. One thing to mention here is there's actually no big magic that we do, right? So there's no performance gain or anything in there. So if I execute this again, and we just look at the plan here, you would see that we... Oh, executed a bunch of things, obviously. Sorry, one second. Okay. If you look at the plan here, we use the top operator, and we just go over the data, and then we have an offset expression right here that tells us, okay, we just skip the first 10 rows of this result set, and then for the top, and then essentially we apply the top operator, and then we say just the next 15 of this one. So there's no performance magic or anything behind there. It's just a standard way to write the thing. All right. Then this is the example for the result sets. So I have a dynamic SQL string that I hand in here, and I just select the custom ID and the order date from the table, and then I specify a result set and say I want a column that's called ID and it's of type integer, and I want a column order date that is of type date. So if I execute this, this will actually work. And you can see here, no matter what the actual result from the table was, because the names were different, I actually also get the names that I specified. Cool thing here is we would also do the conversion for you. So if I now specify a time here, this will work as well. And then as the orders were dates, the times are all zero. But these conversions work. If you specify something here that is not convertible, we would fail this operation. If you do not expect a result set, you can actually say with result sets none. And in this case, the T-SQL that I executed would generate a result set. So we fail this operation and say, well, here something is wrong with the contract that you want to establish. I think that's just a fancy thing it's not meant to be used all over the place just to encrust that, but I think once in a while it can be handy if you're not sure what is the input or what is actually the dynamic SQL that is being generated. You can make sure that you get the result sets that you expect. And you can, which is not in this demo here, you can specify multiple result sets. So you can have, if you know the first result set should look like this, the second one should look like this, so you can specify this all in this class. All right. Then, as I'm going tight on the time, go right here. So here what I do is I select the order date and just parse it into a string table, and I do a couple of those, and I use this format function. You can just specify a picture string up here. I do the American date format, and then just for the next sake, I just generate a few more strings into this table. And what I do now is I use these cast functions, the try cast, try convert, and try parse functions to get the data back into the data type that I want, which is a date. And they have slightly different format of how to use them. And if you look at the results here, you can now see that we didn't throw an exception, but the operations worked, and we return a null here. You can specify different locales here just to get different formats of the dates. Running short on time, so I'm not going to show this. The last one that I actually want to show is the concat one, just concatenation of strings, right? And here I constructed my name. This is not that interesting, but if I add, for example, null, and just a space here, and the one, and then... Well, let's forget about this one. To make it easier for me. So now what we would do, we would actually parse this integer into a string, and we also take care of the null for you, right? So you don't have to be worried there's something that we cannot parse, right? What it can do is you cannot select over a table and get a bunch of strings, and we would concatenate them, right? So this only works for a per row. So if I select over the strings table, where I had a bunch of strings in there, you would see would just generate the outcome per row. So we are not actually collapsing these rows. All right. So I will hand out these demos, and there's examples for if and choose. I guess this. I hope you're not mad that I skipped those two. Then we have like 30 seconds for questions right now. Which I'll be sticking around for a few more minutes, and I'll be in the TSC area tonight from 7:30 to 9, and then also tomorrow and on Wednesday if you want to find me. We have some related content. Thank you very much. And have a great rest of the week.